Good evening and welcome to Spotlight on Manx Radio. I'm Michelle Kane with you this evening on behalf of Howard.
Spotlight, brought to you by the Isle of Man Arts Council.
Today has been one of those days that reminds us just how beautiful the Isle of Man can be. Sunshine, blue skies and warm temperatures have made a welcome change. And if you've managed to spend a little bit of time outdoors today, I hope you've made the most of it. He's hoping the weather sticks around for a while yet. It's a packed programme this evening celebrating the island's vibrant arts and culture scene. We'll hear from Jim Rawson, Arts Development Manager at the Isle of Man Arts Council, talking about his first year in the role. We'll also be joined by Tiffany Cruish from Culture Vannon to hear all about this year's Cúisifear, celebrating the Manx language and culture. Then later in the programme, I can share details of the upcoming Isle of Pride event before hearing from local author Robert Stimpson, who will be telling us all about his new book about the Queen's Pier restoration. As always, if you're involved in the arts, have an exhibition, a performance, workshop, or even a creative project that you'd like us to feature here on Spotlight, please do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. You can email Howard Kane with an E at manxradio.com. or spotlight@manxradio.com. Starting this evening's programme, Howard caught up with Jim Rawson, the Arts Development Manager at the Arts Council, on how his position has been going since taking over just over 6 months ago and what the Council is about. Now, the Arts Council was established in 1965 supporting and promoting the arts across the island through funding, advice and community engagement. So let's hear what Jim has to say.
It's been going really well, yeah. I mean, it's really different to what I was doing before. So it's been a bit of a learning curve, but I think I'm sort of slowly starting to get the hang of things now. And it's been really interesting. It's lovely to be sort of connected back with the sort of creative community again. And just generally be, you know, helping to sort of support some of the creative activity on the island and the creative community. Yeah, it's been great so far.
And give us a bit of your background then. So did you come from an artistic background yourself?
Yes, I did. I mean, I've been interested in art and music as long as I can remember, really, from a child. And, you know, my family are quite creative. My dad was a musician and mum's always been into making stuff. So, yes, I've got that in my blood, I think. I studied art and design at university. And then I sort of came back to the island and I worked for a while in publishing. I think in my 20s, as lots of people do, I did lots of odd jobs and things, and finally seemed to settle around about the early 2000s into digital work. So I sort of moved from publishing into the internet and that kind of thing, and ended up with quite a long career, which sort of culminated in head of design for a software company on the island. And then during that time, you know, my family sort of grew up, really, and I think I got to the point where I just sort of thought, oh, I fancy a change, and I'd maybe like to go upwards a bit and do more of the arts stuff that I was originally into, I think.
Was it the idea of returning to your sort of artistic roots that drew you to the role at the Arts Council?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I'd been looking for a while, you know, to make a bit of a career change, and I liked the idea of being able to help the creative community, really, and I think that sort of happens here through a number of different ways. You know, it can be funding through the Arts Council grants and awards, or it could also be just, you know, just having a chat to people, asking venues what kind of challenges they're up against, and seeing if we can help them find solutions to those challenges. So, yeah, it sort of feels like a good thing to get behind.
So has the role thus far been anything like you imagined? Or sometimes you go into a role having an idea of what it is and then it's nothing like it and vice versa. Whereabouts are you on that sort of spectrum?
It has. There's definitely been some things that, you know, I expected, and there's then been a lot of stuff that I hadn't expected as well. I think the sort of scale and breadth of the role is quite big, really, because I'm also working with Kensington Arts on some of the activity that happens there. I think the thing that's really surprised me is because I get to see all of the applications for funding, it's really given, I think the team here would agree with this, you know, you get this really interesting picture into the activity that's happening across the island and often, you know, away from the island as well. So it could be artists or creatives that have left, you know, and they're sort of continuing their journey, but actually they've still got that connection with the island through that kind of Manx diaspora kind of creative thing, and they'll still come back to council and either ask for money or they may just want to update us on, you know, well, you know, you funded me sort of 3 or 4 years ago and I'm doing this now. So I think that's been really, really interesting to see, and it sort of gives you this really nice kind of view of the landscape of the creative community on the island, which is great.
So what do you think is the actual major role of the Arts Council? Because again, there are those who know it intimately and others who say, oh, Arts Council, what's that then?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're very much there to sort of steer and support, really, I think. You know, there's a lot of debate, really, isn't there, about the sort of role of arts and creativity in society. But I think what I would say is that really arts are more than a nice to have. You know, it's not some frivolous thing. Really, the arts are vital, you know, for a prosperous and inclusive society. And I think that, you know, we're sort of seeing that really reflected in the type of applications that we're getting. You know, we've got an increase in sort of applications that focus on creative health and those kind of things. And so, yeah, it's really there to support that, you know, to act as a sort of guiding light, really, for the island and for the community.
And it's an interesting point, that, and I think you're right. You see it not just on the Isle of Man, but you see it across certainly the UK and other parts of the world. And we all know there's been a cost of living crisis and lots of cutbacks left, right and centre. And clearly, war's been going on in the last year or two, which we'll all have seen. And usually when there are cutbacks, one of the first things the eye turns to, all these government eyes turn to, are arts and culture.
Yes, yeah, and it's important to remember that, you know, that's not really an optional thing. If you look at things like socioeconomic ideas, you know, problem-solving skills and critical thinking of the type that are taught in higher-level creative arts are absolutely essential for innovation and a growth economy. So, you know, it's not just about a frivolous thing or a nice to have. The creative industries in the UK are worth about £124 billion, you know, so you really can't separate those things. And I think, you know, we've got a good strategy. That's the other role of council, really, is working in conjunction with the officers and the team here, you know, is that we're really responsible for delivering on that strategy. So the strategy is kind of coming to an end next year. So we're currently at the tail end of that, I suppose, and we've done quite well, really, I think, to get a lot of those things delivered. And then it'll be a case of looking to the future and seeing what else we can deliver from then on.
And is that a lot of your role, looking at this strategic development?
Yes, it is, yeah. And that's council and the arts development team working together, really, on that, yeah. And working with the minister as well, you know, to sort of say, where, you know, where are we going with this and what do we need to do? And then it's my role to help on the practical side of actually getting that delivered.
Yeah. And I think the thing, again, is it's a well-worn phrase, but the island does punch well above its weight when it comes to artistic talent, it all strikes me.
Yes, it does, yeah. And actually, you know, we don't really have as much resources as, you know, comparable jurisdictions in some ways. You know, we do quite a lot with not very much, I would say. We have about somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 a year to give away as part of the Arts Council funding once we take away the sort of ongoing commitments, and we receive about 1.2 million's worth of applications. But if you look at sort of budgets in places like Creative Scotland or even some of the other islands, you know, they have significantly more than that per capita. So you know, we're doing the best we can with what we have. I mean, it sounds like a lot of money, but actually if you think about the population of the island, it's per capita, it's not that much, really.
And that funding for things like the grants and such, like, that's coming from lottery money, is it, or is that...?
It's lottery duty, yeah. And so, yeah, we're also working on a lot of... one of our main themes this year, really, and, well, it always will be, I think, is community. You know, so we're looking at lots of work we can do in schools and community. Emma at Kensington Arts is doing a great job on the theatre and education programme.
That's a little gem, Kensington Arts, I think, isn't it? Tucked away there, there's so much goes on in there.
It is, and it's a lovely historic building as well. It used to be, obviously, the Douglas School of Art, so, you know, Archibald Knox used to teach in that big...
When I was a kid, it was a youth club at the time. It was sort of straight youth club then, but it's a fantastic building.
Yeah, so we describe it now as a youth club for the arts, really. So there's all sorts of exciting things happening there. The theatre and education programme is fantastic, so... We've reached all the pupils in year 6, 7 and 8 this year, which is about 2,000 children. And we've also got summer holiday sessions running this year. So that's like a drop-off session where, you know, parents can get their kids involved in all sorts of creative things, at relatively low cost. So that's really exciting. And yeah, we're just looking to make arts more inclusive, really, whether that's inclusive from a financial point of view or inclusive for people with additional needs and that kind of thing. Through a lot of that's happening through Kensington as well.
Spotlight, brought to you by the Isle of Man Arts Council.
Excellent. We thank Jim. Now, don't you worry, there is a part two to that, which Howard will be bringing you in a future episode. So next, Howard was talking with Tiffany Karuish from Culture Vannin about the newly expanded Cúis Mhuir. Building on the long-running Cúis Manx Gaelic Festival, the event has grown to include an even wider programme celebrating the Manx language, music, culture and heritage, bringing together learners, fluent speakers and visitors for a series of workshop performances and community activities. But don't take my word for it. Here's Tiffany to tell you all about it.
The Cúis Festival is something that happens every year and has done for the last 29 years, actually.
Wow.
And the Cúis Manx Language Festival is a celebration of Manx language with lots of different activities happening normally in November. But this year, as listeners will be aware, it's Year of the Manx Language. And so we're changing things up a bit for Bliain na Gaeilge, and the Cúis is moving to September. It's going to run over 5 days, and the name is becoming the Cúis Mhuir. So Cúis actually means a chat or a sort of small gathering, and Mhuir means big. And so, yes, it's all getting amplified, and it's going to be the most ambitious programme to date.
Oh, gosh. So how much of that is actually programmed so far? Are we still working on that, a work in progress?
It is definitely a work in progress, but the structure is coming together, and we've already got 3 headline acts announced this week. So, and it's actually already possible to book tickets for the first 3 items that we've launched. So we're kicking off the festival on the Friday night, so that's Friday the 25th of September, with the world premiere of Cailleac, which is the first ever Manx language opera.
Yeah, amazing thing.
So this is a significant milestone for the development of the Manx language, and this is going to be a really exciting thing to go to. So very, very special. It's all going to be taking place at the cathedral in Peel. So that's on the Friday night. And then on the Sunday afternoon of the festival, there's going to be a wonderful concert that's being organised by Uncruniacht. And that's going to be a variety concert, and that's Sunday afternoon at Peel Centenary. And then the very special headline that we have is going to be the grand finale of the Cúis Mhuir 2026. And that's an inter-Gaelic concert, and that's going to be featuring Gaelic singer Julie Fowlis and her quartet Alt. And that's taking place at the Gaiety Theatre on Tuesday the 29th of September.
Oh, wow. So a bit of a headliner there.
She is an absolute headliner, yes. Celtic royalty, along with the rest of her quartet. And we're very excited to be welcoming Julie to the Isle of Man. I think she has been once before. She became well known to my colleague, Ruth Keggin, mm-hmm. Who is the Manx Language Development Officer here and also a well-known Celtic singer in her own right. And Julie is coming over with her band. That's Zoe Conway and John McIntyre and Eamon Durley. And they will be coming together in this amazing concert. The idea is it's been called an inter-Gaelic concert, and it's going to be a celebration of the different Gaelic traditions and Celtic languages. And Ruth Keggin herself, along with Rachel Hare, the harp player that is a regular visitor to the Isle of Man, will also be joining them on stage to bring together Manx into the concert.
But also, as you mentioned there, the Cailleac, the first ever Manx opera. Matthew Warren and I have been beavering away on that for ages, and that's going to be something a bit special, I think.
It's incredibly special, yes. The very first Manx language opera ever to be released. It's going to be an absolutely beautiful thing to go and see. The libretto, which I have learned, is the the lyrics when it's an opera that's called libretto has been written by Bob Carswell. So the two of them have come together with Matthew Warren's vision for the opera and his composing talent, and then Bob's wonderful Manx language ability there to transform that into a wonderful opera. And there's going to be two opportunities to see this. Now, the tickets are available for the evening premiere, but because we know this is going to be in high demand, Matthew has actually opened up the afternoon dress rehearsal as an opportunity for people to come along and to watch as well. So if you don't manage to snap up some tickets for that premiere, then there is the opportunity to come in the afternoon and try and have another go at watching it then. And I think that would be a really interesting way of watching it, because there'll obviously be a little bit of interaction between Matthew and everybody that's taking part. So
absolutely. And as you say, still work in progress, more things to come. It's wonderful to have the expanded festival for the Year of the Manx Language. If people want to find out more, as you say, tickets are already bookable for some of these events. Where do they go?
That's right. So the first three events are available to book. We're working on a range of other activities to build the festival. We've got lots of opportunities for people to learn Manx, depending on what level they are, complete beginner right the way through to our fluent speakers. And there's going to be a rural immersion that we're working on. There's going to be opportunities to learn to sing in Manx Gaelic. And we're even working on an event that we're calling Speed Meeting in Manx. So, yes, that we're working on that. The place to go to find out all of the information as it evolves is the Year of Manx webpage. So that's yearofmanx.im. Go to the What's On calendar, and as and when new things are ready to book, we will be launching it all on there. And that's where you will find the links to the opera and to the Julie Fowlis concert and also the Cruinniacht Variety concert.
Great. We'll speak more closer to the time as more things are announced. And we'll find out more about the Speed Meeting. I'm intrigued already.
Spotlight, brought to you by the Isle of Man Arts Council.
So if you're at a loss of something to do this weekend, don't you worry, we've got you covered. Or at least the Night at the Queen's has. We've received details from Isle of Pride about the Night at the Queen's, which is taking place this Friday the 18th at the Old Friends Club. It's set to be a fabulous evening of drag and burlesque entertainment, all in aid of raising funds for Isle of Pride. The event promises a fun and welcoming atmosphere while supporting the charity's ongoing work to promote inclusion, visibility and community across the Isle of Man. And finally on this evening's programme, Howard has been speaking with local author and historian Robert Stimpson about his new book, Queen's Peer Ramsay: Commitment, Complacency, Controversy and Courage. The book tells a remarkable story of the Victorian Pier from its construction and years of decline through to the ongoing restoration by the volunteers. Drawing on extensive research and hundreds of photographs, it explores the engineering, politics and community determination that have shaped one of the Isle of Man's most iconic landmarks.
About 7 or 8 years ago, I put together a talk for the Victorian Society on the construction of the Queen's Pier. And during the researches on that, I discovered there was a court case between the harbour master or the harbour's board and the people assembling it. One was accusing the other manager of carrying on with his landlady, which was unproven eventually, but it got into the courts and it was a 7-hour trial, and it made an otherwise routine assembly quite interesting as far as the references to it were concerned. And after that, we obviously then had COVID and the shutdowns, and I started looking into more detail about the history of the pier and the background, and it went back long before it was built and started in 1882. Right back to the 1850s, where various different locations for the pier were suggested. And the more I looked into it, the more interesting it became, that places like Approach Road in Ramsey, which is nowhere near the current pier, was actually the location for the original approach to a version of the pier in the 1860s. So there's quite a few little snippets of information that I managed to glean. And as I started to put the subject together from the 1850s through historically, the pier's been a very complicated story of people having to being committed to get it built in the first place, and then the sort of the complacency of allowing it to be operated but deteriorate, then the controversy into the early part of this century, where it was neglected and modifications done to it or parts removed without due process being observed. And now we've got the courage of the Queen's Pier Restoration Trust and before them the Friends of the Pier to actually save it and get it up and running again.
Absolutely. And was it popular when it was first built? Was it something that everyone loved and wanted? Because it's not always the case. Sometimes buildings which become iconic were hated when they first went up. What was the case with the pier?
Even at the turn of the last century, in the early 1900s, there were people saying that it's an eyesore on the bay. Somebody in 1938 wrote to the Ramsey Courier suggesting that it was scrapped and the scrap iron sold to Germany, who they understood was rearming. Fortunately, that didn't happen. But over the course of the years until the tour operators, ferry operators, stopped using it in the 50s and 60s, there were hundreds of thousands of passengers using it. I recount in the book one example from Whitehaven, where a ship came in and the harbour master warned the town commissioners to alert every single establishment in Ramsey because there were 580 people looking for breakfast. So the story varies from complacency about it being maintained, the neglect, but the stories about it being used by hundreds and hundreds of people during the First and Second World War. Internees came off ship and used the pier to go to the Volon and other internment camps.
And you do see, like I said, it's mentioned, some fantastic pictures. It must have been beautifully sourced. It must have taken hours to find all these pictures in the archives going back during war years. There's one I was looking at a little earlier on, 1908, I think, with the pier there, or from the beginning of the pier, and the Home Fleet anchored in the bay there, which must have been, again, must have been thousands of people coming to see that at the time.
Oh, yes. Yeah, a lot of the... There used to be a Ramsey marine event each year, the Ramsey, and they used to have the commander sit atop the waiting room at the end of the pier and command all of his vessels and the competitions that used to be run, right up through to when Radio Caroline was offshore. There was one year where they had a swimming race where they swam from the Queen's Pier out to Radio Caroline and back.
Don't think you could get away with the health and safety now.
No.
And of course it was, like you say, you think of it being used for leisure purposes, but also, you know, thousands of people came along, another great picture with loads of taxis and people there waiting at the base of the pier, waiting for all these people to come off the steamer, which you can see sailing away into the distance.
Oh yeah, I've managed to find references to the early horse-drawn cabs waiting for passengers, and a horse-drawn cab driver being taken away by the police for mistreating his horse because he was intoxicated, right the way through to the modern ones where you've got cars, modern petrol cars. There's photographs of that as well, and it was quite useful because one of the cars was quite rare and was able to date the photograph within 2 or 3 years in the 1950s because this car, this Vanguard, disappeared from production very quickly.
Another one I like, picture-wise, which is a really quirky one, I think it's about 1920s or 30s, Tommy Thompson, the chap who I think was the sort of ran the ticket booth, and he had his messenger dog with him as well, who's got an envelope in his mouth. Yeah. I don't know where the dog ran to and from, but I love the idea of having his messenger dog around. It sounded like quite a character.
Yeah. Yeah, the other thing about that Tommy Thompson was that his kiosk on the landward end of the pier, he apparently had quite a number of shelves in it full of models of vessels that the steam packet used, and he was quite a popular gentleman. In his earlier years, he managed to rescue somebody who got into difficulty on a high tide by throwing them a life buoy and then helping them being pulled up the legs of the pier. And so there's been quite a few examples of things like that. What I've tried to do within the book is to show the people using it on a daily basis. The police who apprehended a thief on board one of the vessels before it departed the pier. Coast Guard that manned the end of the pier during the Second World War, who rescued a child that had been on the pier and fallen off the steps. He dived in and saved her from drowning, and then got a Humane Society Award a few months later. So there's been an awful lot of people use it, and very, very popular.
How long was it in actual the research and writing? Because there's just a humongous amount of work clearly gone into it, the amount of detail, and as it sort of says, it's basically, this is, and I think will remain forever, the authoritative book on the Queen's Pier, because it's difficult to imagine there being any more to actually put into it on the detail from the point of view of, you know, its history, its construction, its background, right up to the current restoration.
I just started it 2018, 2019, so it's taken about 7 or 8 years to pull everything together. And the photographs themselves, obviously a few appeared then, but I did an appeal, public appeal in 2024, and the MITRE here in Ramsey very helpfully helped out by allowing me to use one of their rooms. And I think it was mentioned on Manx Radio that I was looking for photographs, and had quite a few people come along with pictures of, well, one lady in particular had a picture of her grandmother in her bathing costume under the pier at about 1920. I got photographs of repairs to the pier. There was a barge that broke loose when they were taking down the end of the pier, and that smashed into the legs right adjacent to the promenade. So there were some very interesting, very unusual photographs, and some very rare ones as well.
Spotlight, brought to you by the Isle of Man Arts Council.